let's really show that this music, that all Baroque music is dance music. And what do we mean by that? For me, it means it has to make me want to dance. I don't care, really, what made Louis XIV want to dance. I'm not him. I don't, like, he's not in the room. And what's gonna make us want to dance? It's a little bit, it's probably something different, you know? And that's okay.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. I've become a big fan of Ruckus, a dynamic early music ensemble, and I so enjoyed this uplifting conversation with Clay Zeller Townsend, their artistic director and bassoonist. You'll be hearing clips from the Edinburgh Rollick with music from the Neil Gall collection featuring the violinist Kier Goquilt. And because this music is very much at the crossroads of Scottish traditional music and Baroque music, it delights audiences who are more into folk as well as Baroque. Listeners interested in creative pursuits will be inspired to hear Clay's ideas around crafting something truly personal and unique and connecting with audiences, as well as the importance of access to music education at all levels. We also got into Ruckus's Fly the Coop project with flutist Emmy Ferguson, with a wonderfully fresh take on the music of J.S. Bach. And a lot of what Clay shared was how the musicians connect deeply with their audiences with contemporary relevance in many different ways. There's a lot more to this episode. You'll find the track names of the music included in the detailed timestamps. The complete show notes on my website will take you to Ruckus, other episodes you'll love, the video, podcast, and transcript for this episode, along with different ways to support this independent project for which I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Now to Clay Zeller Townsend. Hey, Clay, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks, Leah.
So I had not known about the Ruckus ensemble before I heard about you, and I was just like, I've been blown away, not only by your recent album, but your first album, and I've listened to both of them so much. So I'm keen to dig into this. Actually, it's an interesting concept. So maybe for people who haven't heard of you, explain the concept of the group.
Sure. So Ruckus is a continuo band, which is a really specific, special ensemble type built into Baroque music. And it's basically just a rhythm section that is on 18th century, 17th century instruments. So we've got, you know, keyboard, harpsichord, theorbo, the huge big lutes of all different sizes, guitars of different shapes and sizes, cello, bass, bassoon, percussion. It's really quite similar to like the rhythm section in a jazz in the jazz idiom, and continuo functions similarly. They're providing rhythmic texture to Baroque music, and we're also linked up with improvisational practices from more recent centuries, in that in Baroque scores, there is not every bit of information needed to see the piece. So let me say that again. Baroque scores have an openness to them, and continuo players are improvisers in this 18th century idiom, and they take this open notation and create texture that serves to bring the character of the music to life. And we can talk more about like what are the mechanics of this, what does that actually look like on the page, but the gist of it is that this is a section of rhythmic improvisers who create texture to make something really vivid. And our goal in Ruckus has always been to make a very personal, unique approach to continuo practice. And it just sort of, we found ourselves moving towards this very groove-oriented, very dance-oriented kind of house style which is, I think, you know, really indicative of what Baroque music is, and especially what it is for us. When I was first getting into Baroque music, I was a student at Eastman, and I was taking this performance practice class by the legendary lute player Paul Odette. And Paul would say that, like, there was a time where you could hear a recording of a modern symphony orchestra. I think he was thinking of like the mid-20th century. And you would know just by the sound, the sort of attitude, the color, like the sound of that, maybe it was the first oboe, you know, really indicative sound. You could be like, oh, that's the Philadelphia Orchestra. I know exactly who that is. And you don't have to tell me who it is because I can identify it by this sense of unique style. And I think a lot of modern orchestras have sort of like smoothed out the edges and became a little bit, you know, a little bit homogenous, a little bit similar. I don't know if you could really pull that off right now, comparing two live performances of the same piece. And I was captured by this idea of like, oh, when someone hears a Ruckus recording, I want them to be like, I know that's Ruckus. Like, I mean, that's like, no one else does things like that. It's very like specific to them. And it's not Les Arts Florissants, and it's not Handel and Haydn Society. It's like, we're our own thing. And, yeah. And that's because we built a sound based on a core group of players who each have their own background and interests, and our goal the goal in all chamber music is to like pull that out of each of your crewmates, and to make your own personal sound.
Yeah, I agree, and there's like a very expressive earthiness that I really enjoy about your playing. And what I find, like, I did play, I studied Baroque violin, and I did play a lot of Baroque chamber music at a certain point. But then as a modern, like, I'm in a modern orchestra, and when we work with people who do historically informed performance, I find it gets a little, with some people, it gets a little precious, or the interpretation of that does, because it gets very picky, and they're like, no, this articulation, that articulation, and you're trying to corral this big group, you know, to get them to do certain things. Anyway, that's... But of course, I agree with what you say about the homogeneity as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can often get lost in the weeds and lose the big picture because we're seeking uniformity of approach, or we're seeking, you know, with good intentions. You know, we do want to. It's really satisfying to feel like you're really one with each other in your articulations and with your dynamics and all that. But I think we can often. I think there's a contemporary Baroque style that is pretty in the box, pretty focused on elegance as like the final goal, and to me that's just one thing.
Yeah, I so agree with you. So let's get into the album a little bit, because I want people to have a taste of it throughout this episode.
Cool.
So first of all, I had to Google how to pronounce, so it's Goguilt, but is it Kier? I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, totally. Kier Goguilt.
Okay.
Yeah.
So wonderful, wonderful violinist Kier Goguilt, who's also a researcher. So can you talk about the music? I think what's going to be interesting for this episode is people who are really into folk music, or it's really going to resonate with them. So I thought it might be fun to start. I think it's the final track, the Jenny Nettle set. It has some nicely prominent bassoon.
Indeed, yeah.
We'll be right back.
Keir had been digging through these collections published under the Neil Gow name at the end of the 18th century in Scotland. So we're talking 1780s, 90s, 1800-ish. So they're attributed to Neil Gow, but that's just kind of, that was sort of a marketing ploy. These are a lot of tunes that are from the folk ether that were collected and published in a book. So this is what's pretty rare, is that, you know, oftentimes folk repertoire is disseminated orally, right? It's not often that it's really written down, which is so cool about these. So the Gow family, mostly Neil's son Nathaniel, collected four books of dances from the end of the 18th century. Some of them are definitely originals. Some of them are definitely traditional tunes. There's, you know, jigs, reels, and strathspeys are the main kinds of dances. Strathspeys is a slightly slower, more refined dance than jigs and reels are. And there's definitely a attitude of, because these are written down and published, they're meant for the upper and middle classes. And they have a fair amount of written out ornamentation. There's a slight elegantizing of these earthy, rustic, traditional folk forms that happens in the book. So the Gow family is definitely interested in bridging folk tradition and sort of the salon concert world. That is something that Neil Gow did as a performer. So this is how most people in Edinburgh and the surrounding area knew of Neil Gow at the time, as he was the most virtuosic fiddle player in the area. And he had patronage from, you know, some of the major wealthy families in the area, playing usually social dances with a small band. Usually his son Nathaniel was playing the cello with him. Sometimes they had a slightly bigger ensemble. And if you look on the score of these pieces, it's for, you know, you get the fiddle line and there's a bass line underneath. And it's published that it could be played for violin and cello, or violin and keyboard, or just keyboard. The presence of the bass line is really crucial for, you know, for us as a group that's a continuo band, and also just as a unique signifier for this kind of repertoire. It's rare enough that folk tunes from the 18th century were written down. It's even more rare that they're accompanied by a bass line to show harmonic language, to show even some melodic interplay going on. And that really became an invitation for us as a Baroque continuo band to do our thing with the music. It felt like a really perfect sort of synergistic collaboration with Keir, who really owns the repertoire, really spent years digging into it, and compiled these sets that link one tune to the next, you know, like as any folk performer would be used to. You link these small units together to make these compelling dramatic forms. So that's what the Edinburgh Rollick, the record, is based around, are these sets from the Gow collection at the end of the 18th century, both traditionals and originals, compiled under the Gow name.
So how is Baroque bassoon different than modern bassoon? I assume there's fewer keys.
Cool. Yeah, I got less buttons. Yeah. And I think more importantly than the buttons is the fact that the body of the instrument is just wood. So that doesn't sound that weird, but on the modern bassoon, you have lacquer, you know, to protect the wood. You've got all this stuff to protect the wood. And there's actually some rubber on the inside of the bore. And what that does is it focuses the overtones of the sound. So it's sort of like takes a, the Baroque bassoon sound is just wood and it's very open and it's not made to project far. It's made to sort of, I like to think of it as like gathering sounds around it. So it, it blends really well with strings, which is its main function, to blend with cellos and basses, to play in unison with those guys. And it blends really well with gut strings. So it's really made to blend instruments. That being said, sure, it can stick out as a solo instrument, and I'm happy to do that. And I also love that there's this thing about the bassoon where you can access something a little, you can like turn on higher overtones to get this like brighter color. It's mm-hmm. a little more nasal. And the Baroque bassoon loves doing that as well. And I played saxophone as a kid and it can definitely, you know, speak like a saxophone does. So in the Jetty Nettle set, you'll hear sort of this like earthy Barry Sax like quality of the Baroque bassoon, which is super cool. And at the end of the set, I'm functioning as like that bridge between high and low sounds, sitting in the sort of tenor baritone range, to just basically connect the fiddle range into the harpsichord and the string bass.
Yeah.
It's really a bridge instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've started linking directly previous episodes when I put these out, so I'll be giving people a note about that later. But with my colleague Christopher Millard, he was our principal bassoon player here, who retired, but we discussed quite a bit the physics of tone production on the bassoon and the overtone. So if people are interested in that, I'll have his episode linked along with some people who do early music as well. So just to connect those. So yeah. So in terms of working out the arrangements.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a big part of what we do in the room. We have a, I think, a pretty good process, which is very time consuming, and it really, it's about like the whole length of a project's given life allows for arrangement to happen. So we are arranging continually. These are not, we don't want it to be too fixed. But that being said, we do make decisions. And the way with the Rollick it worked is that everyone played at the beginning of rehearsals. And we had these sets compiled where we knew what tune was going to go into what. And maybe we knew, like, okay, this is going to be a quiet feature that's maybe not about the bassoon, not about the harpsichord even. Maybe it's just, like, the viola da gamba and the guitar and the fiddle. We just, like, there's some sort of, like, we, you know, anchor ideas. But we really try and keep the decision-making open to the generative ideas of improvisation. And that means doing things a lot, doing things, you know, in repetition, and not, and really trusting the people around you and trusting people's own editing process. And it's really also been, it's sort of like a, it's a conversation that we've had as a group for, you know, the 7 or 8 years that we've been playing as Ruckus. And it's just really important, if you're improvising, for people to feel free and for people to feel unconstrained. And if you start, or if you lead with no, it doesn't work, right? Like, this is the mantra of high school theater teachers everywhere, is yes and, right? and I think that's really no better rule for when you're generating arrangement, improvising together with other musicians. I call myself the artistic director of Ruckus, but I'm not the music director. We don't have a music director, and those are like very different roles. We really try to keep it open, and that being said, like there are these just sort of like anchor orchestration ideas that we definitely like decide who's going to come in when, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. or else it would just sort of be like everything all at once all the time, which is really fun, but isn't as compelling for the audience. So we try and make like medium scale decisions that we feel good about. Basic dynamics, basic orchestration is pretty locked, and then everything else, aim for openness, aim like maybe we use like more abstract ideas to link up to keep our improvisational textures coordinated, but it's an ongoing endeavor. And the thing that the trust is like so crucial and so hard, because you really want to like knock it out of the park each time and be specific. And there's such a different thing from rehearsal attitude to performance attitude for us, and probably for a lot of people. I mean, probably for most musicians, where rehearsal is fun and just like there's a lot of silliness that comes out of in our ideation, and we're really trying to just keep the room alive. And if we're laughing, then like we're doing it right. And that like silly thing goes away like by 70%. Like we'll like wink at each other in performance, but it self-edits a little bit. And I think that's always like the hardest for me personally to remember, because I want to be like, hey, can we have a show, like we should like actually like link up on this, right guys? And it always happens, because we have a really great crew of musicians.
How about the Mrs. Ferguson Strathspey? It's a nice
concert.
Yeah.
So that one is, Strathspey is a little bit more of a refined dance, and it features the bassoon. This one has a little bassoon moment in it, and I think it shows really well how that instrument can link up with the violin sound. Mm-hmm. It can really become like one thing separated by an octave that I just think it works really well. There's also Mrs. Ferguson Strathspey has a tiny hidden, speaking of silliness, there's like a hidden quote to Ticket to Ride, which our bassist Doug is a Beatles scholar, and it just sort of happened that like each show like there's like a little Beatles Easter egg somewhere.
I love that. played this particular project for dancers to dance to?
Yes. Actually, so that was how we first started working on this repertoire. And we played a couple social dances, both with kids and with adults, with callers of different types. We did one dance with like a square dance caller, but not quite a square dance, sort of a hybrid reels and jig dances that are that were traditional in sort of squares, and also some country dance steps. And the thing that's so cool about playing for a dance is it really is there's absolute freedom in the music, right? Because you're not you've got such a different function. You're there to provide rhythmic vitality, to push the feet into the air, and it means that it can be everyone, everything, all the time, like, and that's fine because it's not you don't have people that are, like, you know, analyzing the narrative of your music in a certain sense. It's like, it's cool to have like big changes in the flow to captivate the dancers, but on a like a more granular level, it's a very like sort of free jazz vibe, and it meant that we could just really explore, feel out, try things out, and it's the most fun. I mean, after like, you know, years of touring and to pretty like staid like contexts, to the life in the room once people begin to dance it's addictive. It's really like it's so life-giving. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's some limitations to it because we do love the like getting into the nuances of arrangement and making something really dynamic on a small level as well. But I think it was really important for us to like live up to the claim that this music is dance music, you know. And that's been a sort of an ethos for us recently is let's really show that this music, that all Baroque music is dance music. And what do we mean by that? I for me, it means it has to make me want to dance. I don't care really what made Louis XIV want to dance. I'm not him. I don't, like, he's not in the room. And what's going to make us want to dance? It's probably something different, you know? And that's okay because he's long gone. And we want to have a good time with these people who are all right here. So let's like get a little more backbeat in the thing. And let's get, you know, all these like rhythmic languages that we've all got in our bodies. And
sometimes you add to the percussion as well.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit. It's useful because, I mean, if it's not in the way, it's useful, but it's, bassoon is, it's just, in my opinion, it's a sometimes food. It's a really present presence, and everyone else has these rhythmic instruments, the guitar and it's, you know, some spoons are fine and some tambourine is good. And even, the occasional, like, we did a handle opera this spring, and we found that we really needed some drums in the recitativo just to like make things really crackle and dramatic. So yeah, you know, I mean, more options the better. I mean,
yeah.
A few years you might see like, you know, jingles on my bells, I don't know, but
before we get into opera, projects, which is interesting. I was just thinking of a former guest of mine. Have you met Alexis Chartrand?
Mm-mm.
So he's based in Montreal. He's a traditional Quebec fiddler, but he also plays Baroque violin, and his mom is a Baroque dance scholar and teacher, and his dad is like a traditional Quebecois dance caller and teacher.
Amazing.
So he grew up playing for dancers, and there's that whole world, yeah.
Amazing,
yeah. You guys should connect.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, so opera, you guys accompany opera without a conductor.
Yeah, yeah.
What's that like?
Hard, very hard. And the best, because well, it's possible because of the space that we're in. It's not a pit. We're on the floor with the audience, in Hudson Hall. It's a, 300-ish seat hall, proscenium stage. We're right in front of the proscenium on the floor, and our director collaborator, Arby Schlother, loves what we do. Is very receptive to our energy, and most recently with Giulio Cesare sort of built the stage around our setup so that we would have easy sight lines with singers and not have to like coordinate with someone singing backstage or something crazy, but it's it's a 13-piece band with, five to seven singers, depending on the show. And, I mean, Baroque music doesn't need a conductor. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't, you know? It's just not, I mean, it needs decision-making, and it needs attitude, and you gotta be connected with your singers. But, like, it was often led by someone from the harpsichord, someone the first violin, and we sort of operate as a collective conductor. I mean, there's a tiny hierarchy within the collective, in so much as like myself and our keyboard player, but we really like believe in chamber music. And as soon as there's a conductor, people begin to check out. It's unfortunate, and it's because their responsibility is sort of, handed over. And I think we get really compelling results that are alive, and that's because our decision making person is shared. There are some, I guess, there's probably some limitations by it, because I don't know, but we get things out of our group of people that I think are really, like, that wouldn't happen otherwise.
I'm thinking, and the singers probably can hear you better because of the setup.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, singers can hear us great, and we can hear them great, and we are just right with them. I mean, the other part of the process that's essential is that the whole continuo section is at every staging rehearsal.
Mm. Wow.
That's a lot. So that's a lot, and it's exhausting. But I have so much respect for rehearsal pianists after doing this. I mean, because I'm playing we don't have a whole orchestra. So I'm playing the horn part, and then I'm playing the viola part, and then I'm playing the first violin part, and I'm playing the bassoon part here. And then like the bass is playing the second violin part. And we're all just like trying to cover everything in staging rehearsals to approximate and to learn the score, because we're a bit chaotic and we show up like with vibe, but we don't like have a plan for how it's all going to go. So we basically learn the piece in the staging rehearsals, and we know exactly how those singers breathe, mm-hmm. and we know exactly what's going to happen with them, so that by the time the rest of the strings show up, we are basically just like, come on board, let's ride this train, just come on, just like stay with us, we're not slowing down. And it works pretty well. I mean, it's it's not the most efficient, but it gets great, I think, results. Like, and I think because of who we are, it's this thing that I think a lot of people, that really excites me about these operas, is how we get recitativo to really be, mm-hmm. Free jazz meets like vaudeville meets Handel. I mean, it's very, it's just, there's any sound is could come out of the orchestra during our recitative, mm-hmm. which is usually the death of Handel.
Yeah. So speaking of singers, on the Edinburgh Rollick, you have the Broom of Cowdenknowes with vocalist Fiona Gillespie. So had you worked with her in previous projects?
This is the first project she did with us. And she's she does a lot of traditional Celtic diasporic music, does a lot of early music. We did more with her. We do more with her live than on the record. We had some, you know, logistical timing constraints that just meant that we had, the two, Lord Gregory and the Broom, were her songs on this show. But she also plays penny whistle, and that comes out much more in live performance. Also, these we're finding more and more interesting songs, like these, you know, songs that are also made to dance, for make people to dance to, that are super cool because they're non, the texts are sort of just sounds, they're not words in Gaelic. And yeah, what I love so much about her voice is that it's got this like real core to it that's I think kind of special among folk singers. It's not like something that would have to be on the mic that is very sort of airy. Like mm-hmm. she's got this real like core of like will in like the center of her voice, which I think is really, really moving. It's not like a big operatic voice. It works really well for the repertoire, but it's just this like lovely strength mm-hmm. To her singing.
So I was thinking, Clay, it would be interesting for people to hear a little bit about your musical path. So you're actually born in Canada, right? But then you grew up. Okay. So you're one of us, but not really.
Yeah, I was born in Halifax. My folks lived outside of Lunenburg, in Chester, and my dad worked in the oyster hatcheries over there for a few years, and then the hatchery wasn't doing well, and his family had moved to North Carolina. So when I was pretty young, we moved to North Carolina, and he opened up a new hatchery. And so I grew up in Eastern North Carolina. But I love Nova Scotia. I did get to go back recently for the first time since I was like two. Spent a month in Broad Cove, which was great. And I might get back this fall to go to Celtic Colors. We'll see. My family's not particularly classically oriented at all. I grew up really interested in and having the most fun with jazz bands, which makes a lot of sense for what I do now. And I was never like, we didn't have orchestras. It was all marching band and concert band. It was band, which is, I think, true for a lot of America. And got on the bassoon because I loved the sound. I had been doing saxophone and I played sousaphone and I was conducting and all this, but the bassoon was the sound that I loved. And I remember hearing it, for the first time as a middle schooler and thinking, "Oh my God, the trees can sing."
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I want to let you know that I've directly linked several episodes I'm sure you'll love with bassoonist Christopher Millard, lutenist and Renaissance specialist Elizabeth Pallett, recorder player Sarah Jeffrey of Team Recorder fame, fiddler Alexis Chartrand, organist Gail Archer, and cellist Juliana Soltis. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commissioned from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Clay.
And so then I came back to it because, saxophone, tenor saxophone is pretty boring in concert band, but fun in jazz band. So I did both of those things. And honestly, like my band director being like, "You should stay on the bassoon. You could get some scholarship money." And it ended up being true. So I went to Eastman for bassoon and just, wasn't feeling the orchestra path that all of my colleagues were pretty drawn to and the festival, that's rigmarole and like excerpt drilling and all that stuff just didn't feel like it was the right thing for me. So when I heard the early instruments for the first time through a performance with Paul Odette and Christian Bezaid, now the unbelievable early keyboard player, it was like, it was probably like 17th century Spanish dance repertoire that was super rock and roll. And I knew I had that in the back of my head and sort of forgot about it and like did my, Marriage of Figaro and Bolero practice and etudes. And then eventually got my feet wet with the Baroque bassoon and made my way to Juilliard. And that's where, I doing an early music program, I met really everyone in Ruckus in those early years. Doug Balliot, our bassist, was there when I arrived, one of the first people I met in New York City. Elliot Figg, our keyboard player, was in my class and an important part of that grad school experience. Our guitarist was a little bit after my time, but we quickly linked up and Paul has this sort of folk music background as well, which I knew was something crucial to my interest. And we did a bunch of different things in different groups right after grad school. We did a lot of new music for period instruments, which is, happening all over the place, but it really sort of got us as a cohort, a broad cohort, thinking a little bit outside of like how to capture audiences' attention, how to diversify a musical experience, and next made a a group called Omnivore with Doug, which we did like covers of Joni Mitchell and Joanna Newsom, and it was very just sort of an experiment. And I told Doug, "Look, we need to just make a continuo group. with these people and do Baroque repertoire in our own way, with our own language, and then it sort of slowly took off. It was right before the pandemic that we started, eventually like recorded our first album with Emmy Ferguson shortly afterwards, which really I think, you know, got a has been something that's been our really great calling card for a lot of people to be introduced to us. All Bach.
Yeah, it's just a phenomenal album. And as soon as I heard it, I sent it to so many people. Like, have you heard this
wow.
yet?
Yeah, it's very fun, and we're still doing it because we love it, and it's a great way for people to encounter Baroque music, I think, for the first time, and be like, oh, this is really alive and varied. Yeah, so Fly the Coop was our first real like project together in a sense. We had done, you know, something before that, but Emmy is one of the great flutists in the world, Emmy Ferguson, and she knew our style. We went to school with Emmy. We've known Emmy forever, and she knew what we were up about, and knew that these sonatas are really great. And some, you know, usually like flute players know of them. I don't think they're like that big in the like Baroque writ large world. There's other pieces of Bach that get a lot more playtime. But our goal was just, let's make these as varied as possible. And what that meant is, like, each sonata is from a different period of Bach's life, and each has its own attitude. And we tried to make each sonata really clearly one kind of color overall. But there are pieces that we kind of recomposed, where we would add an additional bass line, where we would mash up multiple pieces together. And then there are sonatas where we just sort of play it as Baroque music, as the music that was written down. We don't change structurally, but we change texturally as continuo players. And maybe like a little more often than you might be used to. And the goal is just, let's make this Bach feel just like our Handel operas, alive and in the room, and something that is just fresh and vivid. And I think we should play, I'd probably have us play this clip of a Siciliana from the E major sonata, which is one where we did add a extra bass line, and it makes so much sense because the original bass line by Bach is essentially in canon with the flute line, so it's its own real melodic force as opposed to something that's more like a foundation. And so it really works to have a third line, which is the bass line. And it's actually a bass line from Purcell, from one of his songs, which I'm forgetting. But yeah, it's one of our more, it's groovier numbers. And we called the sonata that this movement's from is the E major sonata. We called that one the eccentric, which I think, you know, if you look at it on the page, it seems like there's more like angles, you know, in E major. If you're familiar with key signatures, E major has, you know, four sharps as opposed to E minor, or C major, which are the other sonatas on the record. So we were really looking for something. And sometimes in E major you get double sharps, ooh, and A sharps. So and there's this truth in Baroque music that keys really have a lot of information, and key areas really do mean a lot. And the challenge to performers is, how can you show it really clearly and really vividly to the audience that it means something? And so this is one of our more eccentric recordings.
Just to go back to the Edinburgh Rollick, the gig set has a more conventional Baroque feel, and it has a nice bassoon moment. So maybe that would be interesting to talk about. And actually, another thing about that album before we leave it, I love the album cover, just the image of the shoes. And I was wondering if you have any, like you play many roles in this group, if you have anything to do with that.
Oh, I'm glad you liked that. I'll talk about the cover first, and then I'll go to the gig set. The cover was designed by our friend Nick Pope, and you know, one of the things that I love so much about working with Keir and with this record in particular is that there's a lot of, like, you know, movement on the surface of this, and a lot of activity, and it's like fizzy, and there's lots of texture, and it can be kind of like, it really takes you through a dance hall experience. But I think there's something like that, like deeper down is very calm about how Keir approaches the music and how, like, his just ethos. And I wanted to focus that with the visual language of the album, to sort of like to help people maybe latch on to that. And yeah, we knew we wanted just like one object on the front, and we talked about chairs, but like an empty chair is a bit depressing. I found just an image of, I was looking, you know, going through images to send to our designer for of like that seemed like the right kind of shoe, because we didn't want like those like muddy boots. We wanted something that was evoking dance and had a little bit of elegance to them, but were also well worn and yeah, suggestive of time and place. Maybe more like 19th century shoes than 18th century, but whatever. And yeah, he did just a really, really beautiful job with capturing that sort of spirit of calm and also energy at the same time. Yeah, I really loved
it. It's a genuinely great album cover, and I see a lot of album covers, and I don't think most of them are that good, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell Nick. the gig set is it's one of my favorite sets, because I think it's a really satisfying structure, with really beautiful slow opening. That leads gradually into a dance, Lady Charlotte's, which is a really iconic tune that a lot of different players have different names for. And then it, instead of like ending up, which I think is the tendency sometimes, we bring it down at the end with a beautiful minor jig, the Marquis of Tullibardine's Giga. And that features the viola da gamba, features a little bit of bassoon. And this one just feels really indicative of the album cover. It's there's something really open about this set, really radiant and like energetic, but with this real calm underneath it.
So for many years, you had this very robust freelance life, playing in different ensembles, not just Ruckus, and touring. And now you're settled in Vermont and you're teaching. school?
Actually, I was.
Okay.
I mean, now Ruckus is touring a bit more than I can get away with to teach as well. But I had been. For 3 years, I taught general music 2 days a week, and I would on Wednesdays like run off to either New York City or wherever we were touring, and then hoof it back to be home by Monday morning, and like it just it this past year was too much, and that's okay because you know teaching is as performers like it'll be there for you. It's I'm okay with like coming and going to that practice. You know, I'm sure I'll come back to it at some point. I really loved teaching, working with young kids, which I was doing. I was working with preschoolers through eighth graders. And I love that they were rural kids that I was working with in rural Vermont. So I was really their first, music teacher for a lot of these kids. And that's pretty awesome. To provide a space, for those who are like, who love making sound and get those kids in a room together and the ritual of it, the ritual of just singing together, which doesn't happen outside of the music classroom in these schools. You know, they get 40 minutes of music once a week, and it's enough to like ignite a spark and keep feeding it while you have them, but they've got to take it if they want to be good at it, and a lot of them do want to be good at it, they have to like to find time outside of that as well. But the thing that we all know and talk about is that like music is great for kids who aren't like great at school. And I was good at school as a kid, but I loved music. But so but to have the experience as a music teacher of like making a class for music that is good for kids who are not good at being in class was meant that my classes were totally chaotic compared to other teachers' classes. And it was very, very exhausting, and it very loud. Wasn't great for every kid, but the kids who needed music, I had a great time. And perhaps if I go back to it, I'll find a way of having a slightly more sustainable like energy in the room. But I mean, I have the most respect for teachers who are in that every day. It's really like hard to imagine being able to do that every day. But you know, these days I'm more in New York City than in Vermont, but I'm up here as much as I can be. And
I understand you had an early teaching experience different in North Carolina, working with high school students and exposing them to like contemporary music and improvisation.
Yeah. That was the North Carolina Governor's School, which was, which is like this beaming light of hope in North Carolina. North Carolina has this history of like really good, innovative teaching institutions that were formed in the middle of the 20th century. And Governor's School is a free overnight program for gifted and talented kids from all over the state. They have to choose kids to equally represent the whole state. So it's not just the Raleigh, Charlotte kids. And I went there as a student, and it's the reason that I went to conservatory for college. So I went back to teach for a few summers, and my role was like let's get you thinking about music outside of playing the notes on the page. So let's be improvising. Let's make something with the dance kids. I'm not going to tell you what to do. You've got to make something. And you've never done that before. Often it's just making sure you're exposing music students to as much as humanly possible once they've shown that they're interested in music. And taking, you know, high schoolers who are pretty good at the trumpet or whatever, like, let's make sure that they're listening to some composers working right now who are not in the band, like, slash high school music tradition. A lot of kids are totally unaware, right, of like the broader like classical music culture that's happening, and that's a shame, because there's a lot of stuff out there that I think young people can resonate with and can show them that there's stuff out there that's different and weird and engaging, actually. So teaching, yeah, that was my first experience into teaching, and I, you know, Governor Schools is a total utopia for young people in a place that needs utopias.
I was thinking about the fact that you were able to study Baroque bassoon. I went to Indiana University Bloomington for my master's, and I didn't do a Baroque degree, but I did study Baroque violin with Stanley. But I saw just recently they've eliminated all the degree programs at one of the what used to be one of the most robust music programs in the world. Yeah. It's really shocking. So what do you see as the future for historically informed performance programs?
Well, it was always going to be hard once Juilliard came around, because it's free, right? I mean, like, the Juilliard early music program is tuition free, and that I think put a lot of pressure on other places. And I think it's a great place, Juilliard is, but it's also Juilliard, so it's pretty narrowly focused. But
like, are you in touch with European colleagues? Like, there's much more of a robust tradition over there, I think.
There is. I also know that the Juilliard is also working hard to attract students. I mean, it's a small field, you know? And there are, the challenge is, I think, how do you take whatever you're learning from your school that you're in and take it forward into the world and make something special to you that no one else could make? And how do you find a way to bring it out into the audience? We've been really lucky with just being able to have made certain connections that have really pushed us out of our initial orbit of community. I think there's a risk that with the early music programs being funneled pretty much through Juilliard, that we'll have this uniformity of approach that I referenced earlier. And I do see that taking hold to a degree, a uniformity of sound and of attitude. There's a little bit of a risk there. I think as Robert Mealy said, and I think in an interview, that Juilliard is great at making generalists of high Baroque repertoire. And it means that the level of playing in our string sections and wind sections have just gone up over the last little bit. There's lots of hungry young players out there who are playing really well. What we need to do is make groups that have a real sense of vivid style, you know, or who are really specializing in music of the Spanish diaspora, or of Latin America, or of like how do we connect being a early music player into this country that we live in. Like, there's so many fascinating alleyways to do that. And I think there are some Canadian groups doing it quite well. And I think we need to really like lead, take that initiative here, because there's so many interesting intersecting cultural threads to pull apart that from the, you know, the last 300 years of American history. So I think that's, for me, that's where the exciting pathway is as a student, you go through school and you need to meet the people who you connect with and who you inspire you, but then how do you make this instrument, this pathway you're on, resonate to the place you're in? Because if you don't think about that, you can be presenting beautiful Bach and Handel and European music in a way that I think is like pretty limited in impact. We have to think about how to connect this stuff to where we come from. And that means as an individual and as a community. It's tough because that's like, it's not the stuff that people like want to buy. People want to go to see the stuff that is comforting and familiar but that's the real, like the real frontier. For early music in America is how to connect these historical threads here.
Yeah, and all classical music, really. Yeah. Those of us doing it well, I think, are doing that. But I was thinking, like, in terms of traditional Baroque music audiences, yeah, you used the word comfort, and I think familiarity, it's dissonant. It's consonant music that's very rhythmic. So it's very, people can just settle into it. But I was curious about some of, like, the other projects you're doing, like the last winter you did the Metropolis trilogy, the Manuel Wilkins quartet. Maybe talk about that project.
Yeah, so this is showing our interest in commissioning works, and also showing our interest in expanding our language as improvisers. So we commissioned a piece from Roscoe Mitchell, who is a legendary improvising musician from the Chicago scene in the mid-20th century. So post Ornette Coleman, part of the Art Ensemble of Chicago for many decades, part of the George Lewis scene, Mulhall, Richard Abrams scene. And Roscoe's a reed player, saxophones. So we commissioned a three-part work that connects period instruments to a jazz quartet through this a spectrum of notation and improvisation. And that means that there are sections where everything is fully notated, fully written out, and there are sections that are totally open, there are sections that are somewhat notated, there are somewhat written out, and there that are about dialogue in this large ensemble. And the process of doing that music making was really kind of the reason to do it, because it just, like, it means, you know, any sound that comes out of your instrument is really viable. And I think that really every musician in the classical field needs to be doing things like this, because it just, like, it opens up your musical sense. It, like, erases the cobwebs, and it gets you out of your ruts, and sort of ticks, because it's so open. And I think, you know, I think it's challenging as an audience person, I think, sometimes. But sometimes you got to do things because it's what you need as an artist. And this is really one of those projects where it just, for a little, we went straight from that into a handful of other projects. And the immediate next day after we premiered this piece in Houston, we caught a 4 a.m. flight and got to Connecticut to play Fly the Coop. And that night we were exhausted, but there was a little bit more life than like there might have been had we not had it done it the night before. And I think, you know, even if it's challenging to the extreme to a listener because it can feel sort of chaotic, it's really the dividends pay off in your body as a performer to do things that are so open. So we hope to record it and have plans to record it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Well, Clay, this seems like a great place to close this out, unless there's something I didn't ask you about that you'd like to tell us about.
Oh, we covered a lot of ground. I think this was great. Thank you so much for your preparedness and questions, and it's very appreciated.
Well, thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.